Welcome to the Political Rewind. I'm Madhani Muturi, and today, campaign turnaround on the bailout. Also, preachers dare the IRS. But first, let's rewind the debate, shall we?
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. John McCain and Barack Obama met in their first debate last night. They clashed over the financial crisis, taxes, spending, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The theme of the night was to have been foreign policy, but the Wall Street meltdown and continuing negotiations over a federal bailout forced their way onto the agenda. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports from the campus of the University of Mississippi in Oxford, where the debate took place.
The first 40 minutes of the debate were devoted to the financial crisis and the economy, the number one issue for voters. Both candidates had flown to Mississippi from Washington after taking part in the talks about a rescue package. Although negotiations continue, the broad elements of a deal are known, so the moderator of the debate, PBS's Jim Lehrer, started off by asking where they stood on the plan. Obama took the opportunity to press his main attack on McCain.
We also have to recognize that this is a final verdict on 8 years of failed economic policies promoted by George Bush, supported by Senator McCain. A theory that basically says that we can shred regulations and consumer protections and give more and more to the most, and somehow prosperity will trickle down. It hasn't worked.
Obama, who has a big advantage over McCain on the economy, wanted to focus on the problem and how Bush and McCain had caused it. McCain wanted to focus on a solution.
Because as we're here tonight in this debate, we are seeing, for the first time in a long time, Republicans and Democrats together sitting down, trying to work out a solution to this fiscal crisis that we're in.
McCain had shaken things up this week by demanding that he and Obama return to Washington to be part of the congressional talks with the White House. McCain is trying to wring some dividend from the economic crisis that has been hurting him and his party in the polls. So last night he focused on what he called his leadership in the midst of crisis, especially his efforts to get the House Republicans to endorse the president's bailout plan.
And yes, I went back to Washington, and I met with my Republicans in the House of Representatives, and they weren't part of the negotiations, and I understand that. And it was the House Republicans that decided that they would be part of the solution to this problem.
But Obama wasn't about to let McCain forget what he recently said about the economy.
10 days ago, John said that the fundamentals of the economy are sound.
Say it directly
to him. I do not think that they are.
Say it directly to him.
Well, John, 10 days ago, you said that the fundamentals of the economy are sound. And
are you afraid I couldn't hear him?
I'm just determined to get you all to talk to each other. I'm going to try.
The moderator tried without much success to get the two men to engage each other directly, but each preferred to address the television audience. Still, there was plenty of sparring on taxes and spending. McCain called Obama the most liberal member of the Senate. He said it's hard to reach across the aisle from that far to the left. Obama tied McCain to Bush.
John, it's been your president, who you said you agreed with 90% of the time, who presided over this increase in spending, this orgy of spending, and enormous deficits. And you voted for almost all of his budgets.
On this, as on other issues, McCain was at pains to distance himself from Bush.
It's well known that I have not been elected Miss Congeniality in the United States Senate, nor with the administration. I have opposed the president on spending, on climate change, on torture of prisoners, on Guantanamo Bay, on the way that the Iraq War was conducted. I have a long record, and the American people know me very well.
Obama got McCain on the defensive by hammering on his ties to President Bush, but when the debate turned to foreign policy for its final hour, McCain went on the attack. On Iraq, McCain said the most important task of the next president is to decide how and when to leave Iraq and what to leave behind.
Senator Obama said the surge could not work, said it would increase sectarian violence, said it was doomed to failure. Recently on a television program, he said it exceeded our wildest expectations. But yet, after conceding that, he still says that he would oppose the surge if he had to decide that again today. Incredibly, Senator Obama didn't go to Iraq for 900 days and never asked for a meeting with General Petraeus.
Obama pressed what he called the fundamental difference between them on Iraq, the decision to invade in the first place.
John, you like to pretend like the war started in 2007. You talk about the surge. The war started in 2003. Sure. And at the time when the war started, you said it was going to be quick and easy. You said we knew where the weapons of mass destruction were. You were wrong. You said that we were going to be greeted as liberators. You were wrong. You said that there was no history of violence between Shia and Sunni. And you were wrong.
Slightly ahead in the polls, Obama wanted to hold his own and look presidential last night to come across as a credible commander-in-chief. McCain came hoping to press his advantage on foreign policy. And in discussing Iraq, Iran, Russia, and Afghanistan, he pointed repeatedly to his long record and experience and travel to those regions. Finally, he summed up his brief against his younger opponent.
I honestly don't believe that Senator Obama has the knowledge or experience and has made the wrong judgments in a number of areas, including his initial reaction to Russian aggression in Georgia, to his, we've seen this stubbornness before in this administration to cling to a belief that somehow the surge has not succeeded, and failing to acknowledge that he was wrong about the surge shows to me that we need more flexibility in a president of the United States than that.
I don't need on-the-job training, McCain said. I'm ready to go at it right now. Obama ended by promising he would restore America's standing in the world.
What the next president has to do, and this is part of our judgment, this is part of how we are going to keep America safe, is to send a message to the world that we are going to invest in issues like education. We are going to invest in issues that relate to how ordinary people are able to live out their dreams.
Neither man has a reputation as a terrific debater, but last night they were both at what may have been their best. Both were relaxed and forceful. McCain stayed focused and didn't get angry. Obama was crisper and less professorial than in his primary debates. Neither committed any gaffes, nor did either land a knockout blow. And the entourage for both declared their man the clear winner. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Oxford, Mississippi.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Renee Montaigne is away. I'm Steve Inskeep. President Bush says it is a bold bill that will address the root cause of the financial crisis, and he's calling on Congress to pass a $700 billion financial bailout package.
Congress can send a strong signal to markets at home and abroad by passing this bill promptly. Every member of Congress and every American should keep in mind, a vote for this bill is a vote to prevent economic damage to you and your community.
That's President Bush speaking today at the White House. Both major party presidential candidates say they expect to support the financial bailout. John McCain and Barack Obama had avoided taking a firm stand until now, but both approve of the plan to stabilize the financial industry. McCain stayed in Washington on Sunday making phone calls to lawmakers. Obama made calls from the road, and he also held a big rally in Detroit, which has had its own financial trouble over the years. We begin our reporting with NPR's Don Gagne.
More than 35,000 people turned out to hear Barack Obama in this city on a perfect fall Sunday in Michigan.
Hello, Detroit!
With the domestic automobile industry continuing to shed jobs, this is a place where deep worries about the U.S. economy did not start with the current crisis on Wall Street. Obama, joined by his running mate Joe Biden, stood on a stage erected in the middle of Woodward Avenue, the city's main thoroughfare.
And I know these are difficult days, and nowhere have they been more difficult than in Michigan. Nowhere have they been more difficult than in Detroit. The auto industry knows something about hard times. So I know it's been hard. But here's what I also know. I know we can steer ourselves out of this crisis, because that's who we are.
Obama praised the deal to bail out the financial industry and in a statement from his campaign indicated he would support it. In Detroit, Obama stressed that the legislation addresses his basic concerns, including guarantees that taxpayers will be treated like investors and that there are rules to make sure CEOs are not being rewarded at taxpayers' expense. Still, Obama said that the agreement is hardly a reason for celebration. And he put the blame for the crisis squarely on the Bush administration and on Republicans for pursuing deregulation at the expense of oversight. He also used the rally in Detroit to drive home the point that using tax dollars to bail out these giant investment firms makes it critical that the United States step up for the little guy as well.
We don't just need a plan for bankers and investors. We need a plan for auto workers. We need a plan for teachers. We need a plan for small business owners.
For Senator Obama, it's a chance to attack John McCain as one who has long favored aggressive deregulation. There are indications that the pitch is playing well in Michigan, with polls showing Obama opening up a sizable lead in the state. Don Gagne, NPR News.
And I'm Scott Horsley in Washington, where John McCain offered grudging support for the federal government's huge financial rescue plan. McCain told ABC's This Week the plan should help to restore confidence in the economy and get credit flowing again, justifying its $700 billion price tag.
This is something that all of us will swallow hard and go forward with. The option of doing nothing is simply not an acceptable option.
Last week, McCain dramatically left the campaign trail to return to Washington as the rescue plan was being negotiated. Campaign aides say McCain made that move after a meeting with economic advisors in which he was warned about an impending Pearl Harbor of the financial system. ABC's George Stephanopoulos asked McCain whether he thought his detour to Washington made a difference to the final compromise.
So what role did you play? How were you helpful, do you believe, in the process?
I will let you and others be the judge of that. I did the best that I could. I came back because I wasn't going to phone it in.
In fact, McCain spent much of Saturday on the phone, talking with Republican lawmakers and trying to rally support for a rescue package. He avoided endorsing any particular rescue plan, and he steered clear of the Capitol and the White House, perhaps to avoid becoming a lightning rod again. He'd found himself in just that role last Thursday when his arrival in Washington coincided with an apparent breakdown in negotiations. Since then, McCain himself has avoided taking credit for any compromise. But campaign advisor Steve Schmidt was not so shy during an appearance yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
What Senator McCain was able to do was to help bring all of the parties to the table, including the House Republicans, whose votes were needed to pass this.
At the urging of House Republicans, the rescue plan now includes an alternative in which the government would offer insurance for risky mortgage-backed securities instead of buying them outright. It's not clear whether that addition will have any practical effect, but by making the measure more politically palatable, it allows the rescue to go forward and allows McCain to get back on the campaign trail. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
It's the Political Rewind. I'm Madhani Maturi. Finally today, politicking from the pulpit.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. This Sunday, more than 30 pastors across the country are planning to endorse or announce their opposition to political candidates. This would be a flagrant violation of a law that bans tax-exempt organizations from involvement in political campaigns. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty explains why the pastors are doing it.
On May 18th, Pastor Gus Booth walked to the pulpit at War Road Community Church in War Road, Minnesota. The presidential primaries were still going on. Booth told his 150 congregants that the next president will determine policy on issues like same-sex marriage and abortion. Then he got personal about the two pro-choice Democratic candidates still standing.
If you're a Christian, you cannot support a candidate like Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton.
With that, Booth gleefully zipped by the line, barring ministers from engaging in political campaigns. The IRS bars people from endorsing or opposing specific candidates from the pulpit. Booth sent an article about his sermon to the IRS so they wouldn't miss it. He and his elders knew he would be jeopardizing the church's tax-exempt status, but he says it's his job to evaluate candidates in light of biblical teachings.
Spiritual leaders need to make decisions. We need to be able to speak about the moral issues of the day. And right now, the moral issues of today are also the political issues of today.
On Sunday, Booth will give a follow-up sermon endorsing Republican John McCain. This time, he won't be alone. 33 ministers across the country will endorse or oppose a candidate from the pulpit. 2 weeks ago, more than 100 pastors squeezed into a hotel meeting room in Washington to learn about what's being called the Pulpit Initiative, a brainchild of the conservative legal group Alliance Defense Fund. Attorney Eric Stanley walked them through it.
If the IRS chooses to come after these churches, we will sue the IRS in federal court.
Stanley says pastors are fed up. In the past 4 years, the IRS has stepped up its investigations of clergy. It sent letters to 47 churches, including some liberal ones, not just for explicit endorsements, but also for using code words like pro-choice or pro-life in relation to candidates.
What's been happening is that the government has been able to go into the pulpits of America, look over the pastor's shoulder, and parse the contents of his sermon. And that's unconstitutional. No government official should entangle itself with religion in that way.
Stanley says they will try to take their challenge all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, hoping that the more conservative Roberts Court will strike down the 54-year-old ban on political preaching. He says the law infringes on the religious speech of ministers. Celia Rohde disagrees. Rohde, a lawyer and expert on charities law, says there's nothing to stop pastors from talking about issues in light of Scripture, but
you simply cannot say to your congregation, you should not vote for candidate X because of candidate X's position on this one issue.
Rohde says if a church can endorse a candidate, it is using tax-free dollars, taxpayer money, to subsidize a political campaign. It's not merely tax deductions that are at stake here, says Ohio pastor Eric Williams. He says it's also the attempt of some churches to move aggressively into politics.
I ask myself, why would a religious leader want to oppose a candidate? Why would a religious leader want to stand up and ask for my support for a candidate who's running for office? They want to gain influence in the governmental process.
Williams is senior minister of North Congregational United Church of Christ in Columbus. 2 years ago, he reported two conservative megachurches for allegedly endorsing a Republican gubernatorial candidate. The IRS investigated one of the churches. He's concerned that pastors in swing states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia will be telling their congregants how to vote.
My concern is that an extreme segment of the, particularly the Christian faith today, is seeking to establish themselves as the public religion of our nation.
Williams and some other ministers have filed a formal complaint with the IRS about the pulpit initiative. Several tax attorneys said they believe the churches will ultimately lose. They point out that in 1983, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a ban on political endorsements by charities. I asked Pastor Gus Booth in Minnesota, what if his church loses its tax-exempt status?
Big deal.
Booth says he can get it back the next day because churches are automatically tax-exempt. Besides, he says, electing, quote, godly people is more important than money. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to The Political Rewind, and we're blogging politics at Vox Politics. Find us at npr.org.